The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
This week we're featuring more segments from other audio projects. Property is theft. In this context, the far right has been organizing a call-out for anti-immigrant demonstrations across Europe for February 6th of this year. In response, immigrant solidarity, anti-border, and anti-racist groups are organizing a show of force against the xenophobic right. An announcement will soon be upcoming in English at aradio.blogsport.de, among other places, I'm sure, about how folks can get involved in countering the far right.
Firstly, we'll listen to a 5-minute segment recorded by Črna Luknja, or Black Hole in the Slovenian language. Črna Luknja is an anarchist radio show on Radio Student in Ljubljana, Slovenia. The audio is an interview with folks at a self-organized squat in Thessaloniki in Greece. It tells the story of the refugees and activists and their struggle to organize and hold the squat against efforts by the police and the Greek Orthodox Church.
Next, Anarchist Shish's Radio Berlin held an interview with an anarchist member of the Passa Livre movement in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The Passa Livre movement is an autonomous movement pushing for the foundation of free mass transit. The weight of an increase of costs of transportation falls mostly on the poor and differently abled folks who don't have cars and frequently must travel long distances between their homes and employment when they're able to get it. In 2005, the Passa Livre movement began trying to spread toll hopping and other direct action tactics, and has continued for 11 years in various forms. The conversation covers charges, changes in tactics, responses to repression, and some of the cityscape of Sao Paulo, including the recent school occupations by students and other right-to-the-city struggles, such as squatting and anti-gentrification movements.
Lastly, we'll hear a segment recorded again by A-Radio Berlin out of Germany. The audio is a recording of part of a presentation by Sillet magazine of Kate Wilson, a longtime anarchist and activist from the UK, about her long-term friendship and romantic relationship with Mark Kennedy, an undercover police officer who had infiltrated protest groups between 2003 and 2010 when he was unmasked. During the half hour, Kate talks about the infiltration, the difficulty of finding out and verifying his capacity as an undercover cop and agent provocateur, of losing a trusted friend and confidant, and some lessons she's taken from the betrayal. More audio from A-Radio Berlin can be found at aradio.blogsport.de in German, English, French, and Castellano-Spanish.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte
Anarchie.
Anarchie. Anarchie.
Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell?
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen
beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarchie!
The following audio is a recording made by activists of the self-organized refugee squad Orfano Trofeio in Thessaloniki, Greece. This material has been made available to us by our comrades at Črna Luknja, the anarchist radio show at Radio Student in Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia. The comrades of Orfano Trofeio tell about the conditions that led to squatting this place in Thessaloniki in the beginning of last December, and about the struggle to keep the place despite of all obstacles. At the end, you will get several contact numbers to get directly in touch with the Greek comrades that are looking for support in their struggle.
In the middle of November, the borders closed for most nationalities. Thousands of refugees were stranded at the borders of Greece and Macedonia. Protests started almost immediately. The railway tracks were occupied, and a parallel camp was created next to the official NGO's one. Already from the beginning of December, police started to make its presence more intense, and the NGOs, directed by the state, spread fear among the people, suggesting that they should leave the spot, while at the same time dozens of buses transported refugees to Athens on a daily basis. On the 9th of December, the camp at the borders of Macedonia, Greece, was evacuated by the police forces and Frontex. Despite their effort to terrorize the refugees, those who didn't give in were violently put into trains and buses in order to be transferred to Athens. The self-organized No Border Kitchen was also evacuated. Volunteers, solidarity people and journalists were taken away by force under the threat of arrest. Once again, violence and state repression were hidden away from the public. On the 5th of December in Thessaloniki, Greece, an old abandoned building, Orfanotrofeo, was occupied by Solidarity people. The legal owner of the building since 2011 is the Church Incorporation. The squat took place as an answer to the upcoming evacuation of Idomeni, not only to provide shelter, but also to become a place where both people in Solidarity and refugees struggle for their rights and demands. The assembly of Orfanotrofeo consists of the inhabitants of the building and people from the radical movement, communists, anarchists, and the authoritarians. Our demands are open borders for all, free access to the health system for all, papers for all immigrants as a crucial part of the struggle against their social marginalization and devaluation. The squad of Orfanotrofeo is a self-organized structure which operates with the equal participation of immigrants and solidarity people on the basis of unmediated and collective procedures, anti-hierarchy and the respect of the differences. From the very first day, the squad is continuously being threatened by the philanthropist church. The evacuation of the building and its demolition is the church's incorporation main goal, and recently their efforts are getting fiercer. The fact that the building is being targeted the same period that the EU countries have set their anti-refugee policies high in their agenda is not a surprise for us. We want to make clear that we will defend the building and our political choices, that the Greek government, the church authorities, the liberal mayor and the municipality of Thessaloniki, the construction company that has taken over this project and all those involved in the evacuation of Orfanotrofeo have names and addresses. The whole movement stands still against them.
We call all the people to join us against the authoritarianism and totalitarianism of the state and the bosses. Our solidarity can destroy borders and fences. Facebook page, Κατάληψη στέγης μεταναστών Ορφανοτροφείο, Housing Squad for Immigrants Ορφανοτροφείο. Address 186 Λαμπράκη Street, Άνω Τούμπα, Θεσσαλονίκη, Greece. Contact number plus 306989389750. Republic of Macedonia contact number plus 306943620206. No Border Kitchen Samos plus 306946650046. No Border Kitchen Lesbos plus 306949469116.
You can find all the telephone numbers as well as the Facebook page on our blog at aradio.blogspot.de.
The struggle for the right to the city against the intensification of exploitation and valorization is complex and diverse. May it be people in Berlin stopping an eviction, squatting in Amsterdam, taking squares in Greece, or fighting for free public transportation in Brazil. A state with a massive territory and huge cities, and, as in so many places, a classist, racist and sexist division of labor that expresses itself, among other ways, through the public transportation system. As Anarchist Radio Berlin, we had the opportunity to talk with an activist of the Passo Libre movement from Sao Paulo, Brazil, about their struggle.
I'm here with Eva from the Pasa Libre movement, and maybe you can describe for people who never heard of it, what is it about? And
The Pasa Livre movement is a social movement in Brazil that fights for the free pass in the public transportation system, and also for a public transportation system which is owned by the users and the workers of the system.
And when did it start then?
In 2005. So it started after two big riots against the raise of the fare in the public transportation. One in Salvador, Bahia, which we call Revolta do Buzu, so the riots of the bus. And the other one, which is Revolta da Catraca, which was in Florianópolis, which is the riot of the turnwheel, the Catraca. And after two experiences of struggles, there was a necessity to create a movement to help organize the people.
Can you explain why the bus fare or the cost of transportation in general is such a big issue?
Yeah, so in Brazil there are millions of people who cannot use the public transportation system because of its fare. The transportation or moving around the city is very closely related to the right to use the city. So what happens here is that the workers who construct the city cannot use it. So they usually live, the poorest people live in the borders of the city, and they can only use the bus to go to work and go back home. So it's a big deal because it involves the right to use the whole city.
And I heard there's also some daily practice connected with the movement of not paying the...
We try to stimulate people to jump over the barriers, the catracas. So the catracas are the things that turn around when you pass into the bus. And we stimulate people to jump over it, and we ourselves try to practice it as much as we can.
It sounds like it's a very big movement and probably very diverse. Can you say something if there is some common structure or organization framework or something like this?
Yeah, so the Free Pass movement is a horizontal movement, autonomous horizontal movement. And so we have a letter of principles. And the principles are that it is autonomous, horizontal, and struggles for the free pass. And I think this is what unifies everybody which is in the movement. But it's not such a big movement. It's just that people, the transportation is such a massacre to the life of the people that whenever things, the bus fare rises or something happens in the bus, people are already very angry and very anxious to do something about it, so the Free Pass movement can join lots of people, but the movement itself is not that big.
Okay, so it's like in phases that some event happens and then it gets bigger, or
yeah, usually. So we have. I mean, we do a lot of work in schools and in the outskirts of the city, with in neighborhood communities. And also in occupied buildings and with other social movements. And we discuss the right to the city with them, and we do lots of discussions about transportation and public transportation. And so lots of people know about it. And we have some events which occur outside of bus fare rising. So, for example, every 26th of October we have our day of protest, which this is a celebration of the first time that we were able to actually reduce the bus fare in a city.
And when was this?
It was 2004 or 2005, I don't remember, because it was 2 years in a row that we reduced, so I don't know which one of them was in October. But so this day is a national day of protest for a free pass in the transportation. But when there is something like the raise of the bus fare, then it becomes much more massive, and there's much more participation of the population.
And right now there's another increase coming.
Yeah, so the day after tomorrow, so Saturday now, the 9th of January, there will be a raise, about 10%. And we're preparing for a big protest tomorrow. And it's going to be a journade. So we're going to have lots of protests in 2-3 weeks in a row.
As I heard, another big year was 2013. Can you maybe tell us what happened then?
Yeah, so in 2013, the bus fare went up about 10% also. So it went from 3 reais to 3.20. And there were very the protest started not so big. They started with about 5,000 people, and it was a very radical protest. So barricades, people closing very important avenues, and very intense. So a protest almost every 2 or 3 days, and the protest started getting bigger, and there was a crucial day, which was, if I'm not mistaken, June 13, so it was a Thursday, where the police brutally massacred everybody at the protest. And after this, the protest became huge, and there were millions of people on the street in all cities of Brazil. And around the 20-something of June, the bus fares were reduced in more than 100 cities in Brazil.
Since then, did you learn something about the strategy of the protest? Did you plan on changing something now, or is it more or less that you try to mobilize people again and have a kind of same outcome?
Yeah, so the authorities, so the police and the state, they learned how to deal with the big protests. So in 2013, they were caught by surprise. And we don't think the same strategy can actually revert this process again. So this year the idea is to join the big protest with lots of direct action. And we think that the direct action is what actually will make the protests, the bus fare go down.
This means that the repression within 2013 just got really hard. And so you think these massive protests are not that useful anymore?
It got hard and it got more efficient. So in a few ways. So first, the repression became judicialized. So people, before, they would just beat us up, and then they started arresting lots of people and actually going on with processing them. Also, they started their own techniques to control. So in 2013, what would happen is that they would target the protest, and the protest would just spread. So people would continue small protests all over the city with barricades and with lots of resistance. And now the police is using a technique of enveloping the protest. So they stay, keep the protest together. And when they do repress it, they repress it in a huge area. So they continue throwing bombs, making people go further and further away. And then it's very hard to reorganize the protests. So this is what changed.
Is there some kind of structure connected to the movement that deals with the repression, like with prisoners or people who disappear or something?
Yeah, so we take care of all the cases of people arrested in our protests. We have a few lawyers which are also militants, and which do this because they believe in it. And when it's not too many people, we can still deal with all of them. When it's too many people, we try to make contact with the public defenders and try to follow the most serious cases. So usually the cases which involve poor black people, these are the ones which actually stay in jail, and these are the ones that our lawyers will take care of.
Would you say that the broad population in Brazil is like following the calls to protest and is somehow getting the messages that are trying to be conveyed, or is it difficult?
It's very difficult. So people are, I mean, the reality of a poor Brazilian worker is that he wakes up at 4, he leaves his house at 4:30 in the morning. He takes 2 to 3 hours inside the public transportation to reach the work. And then he works all day long and he arrives home at midnight or 1 in the morning. And then the process starts again. And when this happens, it's very hard to mobilize these people. I think the people who mobilize the most in these protests are the youth. So students, school students, and but we do mobilize lots of poor people, which are students, and but it's very hard to mobilize the people who have to work all day long to survive.
You mentioned the students. Is there also some connections with the occupations in schools right now in Sao Paulo? Is the movement somehow connected with this? Or?
Well, so we, of course, we support the occupations and we help with whatever we can. Now the occupations have finished, almost all of them. But during the process, we were helping as much as we could, but never trying to be the protagonist of the movement. The protagonists were the students themselves.
Mm. Yeah. And are there any other connections to other movements in Brazil or internationally?
Yeah, so Movimento Passe Livre is a federation in Brazil. And we organize ourselves in the cities, so it's municipalities. And each Movimento Passe Livre from each city is independent. But we have national meetings where we discuss strategies and tactics, and what we have in common in all of them are the principles. So autonomous, horizontal, and fighting for the free pass. We also articulate with several other movements, usually from the, well, all of them from the autonomous left. So we articulate with movements especially related to the right to the city. So this involves squatters and occupations and other movements of the sort.
Right now we are in a squatted space where we are preparing. Can you say something about this place? Is it connected with the movement?
So this occupation, this building, it was occupied by a movement called Terra Livre, which has several autonomous militants also. And they're good partners. And this occupation occurred when the people living in another occupation were kicked out. So the other occupation we took a very active part in making it. This one we also had some of our militants also came the day of the occupation and helped to establish it.
Can you tell us how the first one happened?
Yeah, so the first one was in the opening of the World Cup, the first day of the World Cup in Brazil, 2014. And it's a building in the one of the richest neighborhoods of São Paulo. The neighborhood is called Jardins. And it was a very big building, I think 14 stories high, with only 2 apartments per floor. Even bathtubs inside the bathrooms, and it was empty for a few years already because of speculation. And in the first day of the World Cup, the Terra Livre called us. Well, before they called us to occupy the building. And the occupation occurred exactly at the time of the match. So when the match was about to begin, the Brazil's match. And to confuse the police, we were all dressed with Brazil T-shirts and yelling Brazil, and gathering together. And we reached the building, unlocked it with a saw, and then we entered the building and occupied.
And right now, what's your perspective for the coming weeks? Are you optimistic, or do you see some problems, or?
Well, there are always problems, but I'm very optimistic. I think that talking to people around, everybody is very angry and very anxious to fight. And I think this is what is necessary. So if things... I think there's a big chance that things will work out. I hope so. On the other hand, I think that the politicians and the police are very prepared this year. So it was a very unusual raise in the bus fare, because this year we have elections for mayor, and they usually never raise the bus fare in the year of election. And if they did that, it's because they are prepared to resist also.
Well, then thanks a lot and good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The Final Straw with Burse and William on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. We're hearing segments recently released by our friends at Anarchistisches Radio Berlin. You've just heard voices from the Free Pass or Passa Livre movement in Sao Paulo, Brazil, around autonomous struggles against transit fares and for the right to the city for all, no matter their class.
As Anarchist Radio Berlin, we had the opportunity of documenting a presentation organized by the magazine Zilip in Berlin, with the title Snitches for State and Capital. Therein, Kate Wilson talked about her relationship to Mark Kennedy and Evelyn Lubis about the spying of multinationals and the undercover research group. Unfortunately, due to technical problems, we could only record the first part of the presentation where Kate talks about her experiences. The presentation is held in English.
Okay, so my name's Kate. I have been, I guess what people call an activist for a long time. I come from the UK. I was involved in Earth First and environmental direct action and in the mobilizations against the G8 summit, and I've been involved in anti-capitalist and anarchist movements for a lot of years now. And in 2003, I met a guy who I knew as Mark Stone at one of the organizing meetings for the 2005, organizing meetings for the mobilizations against the 2005 G8 in the UK. And to summarize a lot, we met. He was very nice, very charismatic guy. We got together, we fell in love, we ended up living together for 2 years. And in 2005, I left the UK and moved abroad, and that's when we stopped living together, but we remained very, very close for a long time. And the last time I saw him was in August 2010. I went to the UK, we went out for dinner. He was one of the few people in the UK that I was still very closely in contact with. And a couple of months later, I received a phone call from friends, close friends in the UK, saying that they had proof that Mark was had been a police officer who was infiltrating the political movements that we were involved in, and that he and that they wanted me to know before they published this information on the internet. So that's why I'm here. Obviously, that phone call was absolutely devastating, and that was 5 years ago, and a lot of things have changed. We have a lot more information now, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the last 5 years. If people have questions about anything else, I'm happy to answer questions, but sometimes it's difficult for me, so please. So in the beginning, when we first got the information about Mark, obviously it was a very, very personal thing. Like, he was one of my closest friends, we had been lovers. And in the 5 years since then, A lot more information has been found out about the police officers, and now I don't actually think of that relationship as being a kind of personal betrayal or something that happened between me and Mark, because it took quite a long time to understand that you know, this wasn't something that happened between me and my friend. Like, the man that I knew and the man that I lived with never existed. He was an invention that was created by the state. He was backed up by state money. He had fake passport, fake driving license, fake bank account. And everywhere he went, he was followed by his handlers. He had his communications will have been monitored. My communications with him will have been monitored. There was a back room at Scotland Yard. He was working for the London Metropolitan Police that were processing the data. He would speak to them pretty much every day. He would be going back there every 2 weeks to do debriefings and get psychological support, supposedly, for the work that he was doing. And there was a command structure that appears to have gone all the way up to the government that was basically making the decisions about whether I would have dinner with my boyfriend or not that night. That's quite a big change from the relationship that I thought that I was having at the time. And it takes a really, really long time to get your head around that and start to understand. The other thing that we now know about the policing in the UK. So when Mark was found out that he was a police officer, obviously, because he was someone that we were so close to, it makes you start to look at other people who you would never think be police officers and say, oh, maybe this person might also have been a police officer, maybe this person might have been a police officer. And they now, in the UK, we now know that 13 people from the social movements, or probably more now, it was 13 last time I checked. but
more common.
Yeah. And of those 13 police officers over the last, 17 years, I've met 6 of them in different mobilizations and activist spaces. I also in March of this year, I now live in Spain. And in March of this year, I got stopped a couple of times by the Spanish police in slightly bizarre circumstances, which eventually led to us having a look at my car and finding a GPS tracker stuck underneath the car. And so I've basically, over the last 5 years, I've basically had to come to terms with this idea that I am what I think is called a person of interest to the police or surveillance community. And so I've got quite interested in surveillance issues and undercover policing stuff in general. And it's becoming this really, since 2012 when the Snowden revelations started, and then there was the undercover policing stuff in the UK, and it's just got bigger and bigger. And one of the things that I ask myself a lot, obviously on a personal level, is why, what did I do, or what was I doing that made me such a, what are the narratives that they create that justifies this massive stuff that they are doing? And one of the things that I've been looking at with the Snowden stuff is about mass surveillance And there's lots of debating about that at the moment in Germany and in France and in the UK about like whether it's okay for them to do this mass surveillance, and this idea that if you don't have anything to hide, then you don't have anything to fear and there's no reason to worry about mass surveillance. And as somebody who has now really quite a lot of unpleasant experience of targeted surveillance, I think that they're actually part of the same thing, because basically what they're doing is they build networks of who is friends with who and who knows who, and like all of their surveillance, whether it's mass surveillance or targeted surveillance, is based on that. It's on building these networks. And and I read somewhere the other day that if you have 50 friends on Facebook, then at 3 degrees of separation from you on Facebook, you will have 1.5 million people on average that are your friends or your friends of your friends. I don't actually have Facebook, but like that just gives an example of how that networking works. And 3 degrees of separation is what the NSA and GCHQ use as the distance that they build the networks, which actually means that the stuff that happened to me could be happening to anybody who is close to the social movements. So what we now know about what they've been doing in the UK is that in 1968, I don't know if any of you have read the book Undercover by Rob Evans and Paul Lewis. Anyway, what they explain is that in 1968, when the Vietnam War was happening, there was a demonstration in London, and that went to the American embassy, and it turned into a riot. And I've heard that the American soldiers were actually waiting behind the door with real bullets, and they were going to shoot people if the rioters actually got inside the embassy. Like it really got out of control. And after that, the police said, "Oh my God, we can't get caught by surprise like that ever again." And some guy basically turned around and said, "Well, give me a budget and 10 police officers and I will make sure you never get caught by surprise like that ever again." And they started this unit called the Special Demonstration Squad. And I don't know if I'm now talking about stuff that you're going to talk about.
No, go on.
They started this unit called the Special Demonstration Squad that has been inside all of the social movements, mostly on the left, but I think also on the extreme right in the UK, just being there. And they're not there to actually catch people for crimes, or they don't go to court and give evidence. They've just been for 50 years inside the social movements because they want to know who knows who is doing what, and they claim that what they're doing is that they're trying to pick out the people who are likely to be violent. But actually, they themselves say that in order to be able to pick the people who are likely to be violent, they have to infiltrate everybody so that they can. So they're just there, and they talk about collateral intrusion, which is basically that. Everybody, so my parents, my grandmother, my entire extended family, Mark Kennedy came to my grandmother's 90th birthday party and met everyone in my family that who are not involved in political movements, they're not involved in any kind of campaigning. My mum's cousin is a cop, in fact, but all of those people were had their lives invaded by Mark Kennedy claiming to be my partner and coming to these family events. And so that's kind of what happened. And so in the last 5 years, what I have mostly been doing about it, apart from getting over the horrible, unpleasant emotional impact of it, is I'm part of a group of eight women that is bringing a court case against the Metropolitan Police in London for a number of different things that include assault and abuse of our human rights. And that's been a really, really interesting process because, again, like a lot of the last 5 years has been about understanding that the stuff that happened between me and Mark was not personal. It was political. And talking with other women who have been through the same experiences, and the women involved in my case had relationships with different undercover police officers over a period of 30 years. So the first relationships happened in the early 1980s. And through talking to them and sharing experiences, we basically come to understand that the stuff that seems very private and personal inside the relationships is actually something that these police officers have been doing systematically, and I think are still doing. And there are patterns that we've identified as things that that we now think are part of how they are trained to emotionally manipulate people and psychologically manipulate people in order to get into your lives. And I think it's important because before I knew that Mark was a police officer, having been involved in a lot of political stuff, sometimes people thought that they were infiltrators in the movement. Like it wasn't a term that I'd never heard of, but people always seem to think that the infiltrators are the slightly weird person who has no friends and who makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable, and you're never quite sure why they're at the meeting or that you don't really understand. And actually, all of the police officers that have been found out, to my knowledge, were very charismatic. They were very close friends with lots of people in the movement, and I think actually we were quite naive not to realize that they are psychologically trained to mirror people. So when I met Mark, he was really into loads of the same things as me. And now when we look at it, after I separated from Mark, he got together with a friend of mine. And when we were together, he was really into caravans and country music. And very shortly after separating, he got into drum and bass DJing and a whole load of other things that were completely different. And were about getting into the life of somebody else. And also there was, there are some examples that we have of really quite blatant emotional manipulation. So Mark used to tell me about his childhood and how hard it was for him when his parents separated, and about how his father abandoned him and his brother when they were kids. I now know that his parents are still together. And there are other examples of things like that. One of the women in the case, the guy that she was with borrowed money from her to go to New Zealand to his mother's funeral. And he wrote her letters from the funeral, talking about how hard it had been and about how he gave a speech at his mother's funeral, and actually his mother is still alive. And these are very, very emotional things that make you feel close to somebody, and they, you know, Mark used to cry when he told these stories, and I guess he was crying about something else, you know, like, the other thing that Mark told me that I think is kind of revealing and maybe important is that at some point when we first met, he I was at his house and he had very little possessions in his house, and it was quite an impersonal space, and I didn't know very much about his past at all, and I said to him, like, you know, we were there, I was spending the night, and I said to him, you know, actually, this is a bit weird, and I want you to tell me a little bit more about yourself, because you could be a cop, or you could be a serial killer, or you could, like this place is, like, it has no personality, and he told me this story, again, very emotional, sharing his secrets with me, that about how he had been involved with the mafia in London, and he had actually been a driver for the South London Mafia, driving cocaine from Granada to in the south of Spain to London, and that was why he had money, and that was also why he kind of had no past and no possessions, because basically he was running away. And that there were maybe some quite nasty people who would want to find him. And he asked me to help him keep his secret. And that was a very difficult situation for me. Like, and we had an interesting... I gave this very similar talk yesterday in Potsdam, and someone asked a very interesting question about that, which was about how... the relationship that our political movement has with secrets actually makes it easier for these people to infiltrate, because, you know, there are some places in the world where you go and tell someone that you're involved in international drug smuggling and they will call the police. And we won't. We will keep that secret, and actually people who have secrets are generally considered to be slightly cooler and more charismatic, and yeah, that actually, and unfortunately I still find that story easier to believe than the real version, that he was in fact an undercover police officer. He before he came to infiltrate us, he was infiltrating he was involved in drug infiltration stuff in London, and so he actually was quite convincing, the stuff that he said, and he always he kept up this persona of having been involved in that mafia stuff for the entire time that he was infiltrating them. And how are we doing for time? Okay. When I asked what people would want to talk about here, I actually usually don't give talks like this in kind of anarchist spaces. Usually I'm speaking to people who don't get infiltrated and kind of trying to let people know, like let people in the outside world know that this stuff is happening. It's quite a full-on disturbing story, and I really don't want to put people off or scare people away from doing political stuff, and I really want to say that all of the bad stuff that happened to me and whatever, I don't regret anything that I have done as an activist, and I wouldn't want to do any of it differently, and, well, okay, some of it I would do differently. yeah, really, like, I think I don't want to scare people off, and one of the things it was suggested that we talk about today is like what we can do, and how, like, if we, now that we know this stuff, what we can do to catch the infiltrators in our groups and to you know keep going and deal with this reality. And I always feel when I'm asked that question that I am the last person that should be answering it, because I obviously got it all really, really wrong. But I get asked it a lot, and so I kind of try to have something intelligent to say as an answer. And one of the things that I think is really important is that when Mark was found out, and actually because I was living abroad, I wasn't involved in that, and I don't really want to talk too much about it because I think it was a very, very difficult experience, and it's something that was lived by other people, and I don't want to represent them. But what I will say from the outside is that I saw some of those people also when I was in when I went back to the UK in August 2010, and I saw Mark, and that was all going on at that time, and none of them said anything to me about it. And I knew absolutely nothing about the fact that Mark was maybe a cop until I was telephoned on the 21st of August 2010. And I think that is a really, really powerful thing that is really to the credit of the people of the research group that found Mark out, because very often when this stuff happens, people... there are whispering campaigns and people tell each other about it, and there's kind of rumors and there's no proof. And actually the way that it was done was that they really kept everything like normal, like didn't let anyone know what was going on until they were really, really sure. And I think the reason for that is actually because it wasn't fun that Mark was a police officer. It wasn't something exciting like out of the movies, like, wow, we're cool enough and hardcore enough as activists that they're infiltrating us. It was really, really f***ing upsetting. Like, he was someone that we were all really, really close to, and so when people really started to suspect that he was a police officer, it was taken very, very seriously. And I think that is really important. Like, if there's somebody in our movements that people think maybe might be a police officer, then take it really seriously and keep it very quiet and try to find out and try to be sure. Because otherwise what we get is people being kind of excluded because they're weird. Or, I mean, in Mark's case... He was a bit weird and a bit different from us. He was working class. He had a job. He didn't go to university. And those are not criteria that I think we should be using to exclude people from our movements. Like, I think it can be really dangerous. People say, well, what are the things that you can say this person could be recognized as a police officer? He had a van. You know, like, again, not something we want to use as a way of excluding people from our movement. So it's very hard to do it that way, to say, oh, these are the things that you need to recognize in somebody to keep them out. And I think I really believe that we need to be open about a lot of stuff that we do, and people need to be able to come into the movements, and we need to be inclusive. And so I think, yeah, it has to be handled very, very carefully, and taken very seriously. And the other thing that I think is really important about of my experience that maybe isn't the things that I think are most important to mention are the things that I just really hadn't expected. So I really hadn't expected that the infiltrators that we kind of thought would be there would be the people that I really cared about and was really close to and really trusted. The other thing which kind of comes from that is that once we knew that Mark was a cop, the emotional responses that I had to that, and I know I've talked to other people who are close to him, that so many of us had to that, were not the responses that we would have expected. Like, if you'd asked me 6 years ago how I would react if I found out that someone was infiltrating, like, found out for sure that somebody in my political movements was an infiltrator, I probably would have given you a really politically correct, hardcore anarchist answer to that question. And that is not how I felt at all. And that is not what happened. And actually, the mix of emotions, and for a very long time, like over a year, all I wanted was to see him again and for him to explain. And the feeling was like someone had died. You know, like someone that I really cared for had died. And except I knew that he wasn't dead, and I just wanted him back. And I was convinced somewhere in the irrational part of my soul that it was all a big mistake and that he could just explain and it would all be fine. And that took a really long time to sort out, and a lot of this process of understanding that actually he never existed and that this was all a big state apparatus that was part of a process of political policing. And yeah, it was very, very important for me to be able to have all of those contradictory feelings. And I think it's something that I want to say here, because now there have been these two police officers already discovered in Hamburg, and it's something that might happen here. It seems to be happening here in Germany. And to really try to be caring with each other about the contradictory responses and feelings that people have, because it, you know, like people's emotional reactions to it are not necessarily going to be the textbook politically correct reactions that they should be having, and we really need to look after each other in those times, and it sorts itself out over time, you know. And then the other thing is kind of what to do about it when you find out. And I really don't have answers to that. I mean, actually, I have been, for the last 4 years, involved in a court case against the police. I've been involved in giving evidence to Parliament about this. I'm now getting involved in a public inquiry that is happening, run by the Home Office in the UK. These are all things that 5 years ago, I would have said, if you find me doing that kind of politics, shoot me in the back of the head. And I really don't have... it's such a big thing, and it's such a complicated thing. I don't believe in the justice system. I don't believe in parliamentary politics as a way of sorting stuff out. I'm not asking for them to change the law, but it's just... trying to get the information about what was really going on and trying to actually do something politically that responded to the scale of what had happened, that's just kind of where I've ended up, because as an anarchist, I couldn't really find any useful response. And if anyone has any really good ideas, I would love to hear it. And one of the few, what I kind of think of as autonomous and not institutionally political responses that there has been to this stuff, is what Evelyn is going to be talking about, which is the work of the Undercover Research Group, who have done a lot of the activist work in actually finding these cops out and getting the information out there. So yeah, I'm really interested to hear what you have to say. Because, thank you. So yeah, I'm going to stop there.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.